politicians and journalists have said for years that our pension system is in crisis. But a group of researchers say thinking about it that way actually does more harm than good. Plus, a man named Terry Allen has been in Illinois prison since the 1980s, but he's never been convicted of the crime that got him there in the first place. It's the subject of a podcast from Frontline and WBEZ. And student debt can get in the way of many financial goals, especially buying a house. We'll hear about people who've experienced this firsthand.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, how a man wound up in a state prison for more than 30 years, even though he was never convicted of the crime that got him there in the first place. We'll also talk about how student debt can make it much harder to buy a house. But first, let's do a word association. Think of state government. Now, when I say pensions, what's the first word that comes to mind? If you follow state politics, there's a good chance that pension makes you think crisis. Certainly, state pensions are a big challenge for Illinois, but according to Amanda Cass and David Merriman, the way we're talking about this issue is actually making it harder to solve the problem. They, along with their colleague Bob Bruno, say it's time to change the conversation about Illinois' finances. Amanda and David are both on the line now from UIC. Amanda is associate director of their Government Finance Research Center, and David is a professor of public administration at the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs. Amanda, David, welcome to the 21st.
Thanks. It's nice to be here.
Thank you.
Amanda, I want to begin with you. That word association, pension crisis, it's almost become reflexive. I would guess you could find examples of it in my own reporting from the Illinois State House. So let's start with the definition. Amanda, what, in your view, is a pension crisis?
Well, we said in our paper that we think that a crisis situation is one in which the retirement systems cannot pay out benefits to current retirees, meaning that people's monthly pension benefits would literally be halted. And that's not the situation that we have in Illinois, and that's not the situation we're facing in the near term. And so that's why we don't think that it's a pension crisis. And then we also think that the crisis label is unhelpful because it promotes a kind of short-term thinking about the problem. And as we kind of articulate in the paper and try to highlight, this isn't something that can be solved in a short term.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that, how this framing affects the way we think about this. But David, I'm wondering, where does the crisis framing come from? Is there somebody that it benefits?
Well, yeah, I think it's often in a political context, the way that you get something done is you declare it a crisis, and then you kind of ram something through without a full consideration of all the alternatives. That's politically favorable. So we're concerned that in the past there have been just a number of occasions in which this crisis framework, why we think it's unhelpful, this crisis framework has resulted in changes in pension policy and in budgetary policy that weren't necessarily, that weren't really long-term fixes and weren't fully taking responsibility.
Yeah. And so we hear these numbers like $133 billion in the long-term unfunded liability. And that's something that people fixate on. Amanda, your report says that, you know, once you get below that crisis narrative, there are really two issues, right? Two issues that you say are both interrelated and in conflict. What are those?
Yeah. And I think the in conflict part of it is something we really wanted to highlight. So the two issues are, one is concern over the pension system's finances and the kind of fiscal health of the pension systems themselves. And then the other problem is the state's overall operating budgets and the kind of perception that the state's annual pension contribution is crowding out spending in other areas of the budget. And those two things are in tension because if you're just trying to improve the finances of the pension systems in a shorter time frame, that would require the state to be contributing significantly more than it is under current law. But if you increase the state's contributions to the pension systems, then you're exacerbating the overall budgetary issues the state's facing.
And this is, people call this what, crowding out is the term I've heard, right? For for crowding out other state spending?
That's what they refer to it as. And we try to explain in the paper that the pension contributions are just one aspect of the state's overall budget, and there's lots of kind of pressure points. We have a backlog of unpaid bills from the two-year budget impasse. We have kind of needs for spending in other important areas of the budget, like social services, K through 12 education.
Yeah, and you have this line, operating budgets where expenses regularly exceed revenues, which is, I guess, in more of a plain English way to say that is like we're not paying for all the spending we're doing in the state, right? We want to do more than we're actually collecting tax money to pay for.
Right. And that's I think that's been a chronic problem for many years is we face this. Another term that's talked about is a budget crisis. And we face that problem year after year and then go for short-term fixes rather than thinking about, okay, what do we need to have, you know, a long-term path where we're going to have enough money to pay for the services that we demand.
So, David, you talked about these short-term solutions that people try and do, and it's, maybe there have been some ill-considered things taken, you know, pressure to come up with a silver bullet solution. What are some examples of that, that we've seen over the years?
Well, we list three in the paper, and, you know, maybe Amanda was going to talk about those.
Sure.
She doesn't mind.
I think the biggest one that we can talk about, and it was kind of just in the news the other day because there was a legislative hearing on it, is the second benefit tier that was created in 2010. And so in 2010, lawmakers passed sweeping changes to the pension laws and created a reduced benefit tier for everyone hired on or after January 1st, 2011. But the problem is that the benefit is so low that it likely violates federal provision in Social Security that requires a minimum level of a pension benefit because most people aren't coordinated with Social Security. And so Tier 2 was created ostensibly to kind of create savings for the state, but in reality, the state's now facing this problem of Tier 2 potentially violating federal law and the state and possibly kind of the local school districts having to come up with a solution to remedy this or pay into Social Security at some point.
Yeah, I was actually at that hearing last week that you mentioned, and it's the safe harbor provision in Social Security, as you talked about. But some people were framing this as a moral issue, right? Because you have people who are contributing 9% of their state pay or like a teacher, public school pay, but they're only getting a benefit that's worth, what, 7.5%, give or take?
Right. And that's another important point is that the contribution rate for people that are in Tier 1 and Tier 2 is the same, but the Tier 2 benefit level is so much less. And so the Tier 2 members, at least for the teacher's retirement system, their contributions are fully paying for the cost of their benefit. And then also there's additional money from their contributions that is paying down the unfunded liabilities associated with the Tier 1 benefits. And so they end up almost kind of subsidizing what the state should be paying for the debt.
So, okay, we're getting pretty far into the weeds here with this stuff. But I wonder, that kind of goes to one of the broader points here. Are pensions uniquely difficult to explain to voters, right? Because they're not necessarily, the majority of people in Illinois do not have state government or teacher pensions.
Right. I think, the idea of a defined benefit pension, which was fairly common in both the public and the private sector at the time the tier one pension system was set up, is no longer common in the private sector. And so I think it is hard to explain to people, why that should be a public benefit. And the disjuncture between the private and public sector, I think, is an issue that's led to a lot of discomfort. I think, a lot of people probably don't realize that most public sector workers are not covered by Social Security. And so it's a very, very different system in the public sector versus the private sector.
Go ahead, Amanda. Yeah.
I was just going to chime in and say, I think another kind of factor in it is that people hear these big numbers, like $130 billion in unfunded mm-hmm. liabilities, and they can't quite wrap their heads around what exactly that means other than it's a big, scary number. And people, they hear that number and they hear that it's kind of a debt that the state owes. And then they assume that it's something that has to be paid off in the next year or the next few years and don't understand that, one, it's an estimate, and two, this is a figure for long-term liabilities. So it's a figure for benefits being paid out to retirees today, but also benefits being earned by current employees that aren't going to retire for another 20, 30 years. And so I think that the kind of like technical nature and the numbers associated with the pension systems can be just overwhelming for people. And they are just left with thinking, oh, we have this big amount of debt. How are we ever going to pay for that? We can't pay for that. We have to cut it somehow.
Yeah, nobody has $130 billion that they can help the state
right.
out with. And you say, Amanda, in your report, like you talk about when people take that number and divide it by the number of taxpayers and you come up with something like, oh, everybody owes $11,000 to help fix the pension problem. You say that's the similar sort of frightening but maybe time insensitive argument, you might say.
Yeah, I think it's actually somewhat unhelpful because I think it reinforces the notion to people that this is a debt that is owed in the near term, and that it reinforces people to think about it in terms of what do they have to pay kind of today or tomorrow for it. And then again, it's these are estimates. And so I think another problem with it is that it reinforces just looking at what the unfunded liability figure is in 1 year instead of looking at kind of long-term trends and comparison with other pension systems around the country. So, when we want to think about Illinois, we want to think about what's the long-term trend in the financial condition? Has it been increasing or decreasing or staying the same? How do we compare to other pension systems around the country to assess what the problem is?
Well, how do we compare to other pension systems around the country?
Well, I
know the answer to that question, but go
right.
ahead.
I think, that's where there's very clearly a problem. Like most pension systems around the country, Illinois' systems saw their finances decline after the recession. Illinois' systems have somewhat just been treading water. And the Center for Retirement Research at Boston College has a nice report, actually, on this topic that kind of highlights that there's almost a bifurcation of pension systems across the country, and that Illinois is in the group of places that are not seeing improvement in their finances and seem to be kind of just declining over time. So that, to me, is what's worrisome, is the trend, not the dollar figure in and of itself.
Is there a point, Amanda, at which the pension crisis definition you laid out a few minutes ago, this idea that we're going to run out of money to pay benefits that we need to pay, do we know when that date is? And we hear about this in the federal context, Social Security is going to not have enough money in 2040, whatever. Is there a date certain for that in Illinois?
Sure. So for Illinois, there is no date because we have a funding law in place. And so if the state sticks to making its annual required pension contributions, then in theory, assuming projections and assumptions are right, the pension systems would never go insolvent. So we'd never have that scenario.
So, David, you say, or really both of you, sir, all three of you in your report say that we should be thinking about pensions in a calm, thoughtful, and deliberate manner. Are there specific solutions you think might come from that calm, thoughtful, and deliberate approach?
Well, I think that I don't know. We don't propose any specific kind of policy change, which I know frustrates some people, but we think what's important is the way that you talk about it, that we think about it for in depth, and we consider it in kind of a holistic way, right? It has to do with the entire revenue system, like what do we want in terms of public services, what do we want in terms of a system of revenue, what kind of tax system we're going to have, and thinking about it in that way. So we don't pretend to to tell either the elected officials or the people of Illinois what the right choices are, but what we want is for people not to obscure the real trade-offs that we face, which is if we want to fund the pension system, then that money is going to have to come from somewhere. It can either come from lower spending or higher taxes. And we kind of can't have both. We can't have both a more highly funded pension system and more public services.
David Merriman is a professor of public administration at UIC. Amanda Cass is the associate director of their Government Finance Research Center. The two of them, along with the U of I's Bob Bruno, are co-authors of a report that challenges us to think differently about our state's pension system. David, Amanda, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey in for Nyla Boodoo. You've probably heard of being held without bail or in prison without the chance for parole, but have you ever heard of being in prison without being convicted of the crime that got you there? It turns out hundreds of people across the country are incarcerated without those convictions. That's the subject of a new podcast from the Frontline Dispatch. It was produced in collaboration with WBEZ Chicago. WBEZ reporter Max Green tells the story of one such man, Terry Allen. He was 23 years old when he was arrested for an alleged sexual assault. He was never convicted, but almost 40 years later, he's at a prison in Jefferson County, and he's never had a release date. Joining me now to talk more about this is Max Green. He's at WBEZ in Chicago, and Frontline Dispatch producer Sophie McKiven is also with us. She's in Boston. Both of you, thanks for joining us on the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
So, Max, this episode of the Frontline Dispatch is focused on a man named Terry Allen. Can you tell us a little bit about him?
As you mentioned, Terry Allen was 23 when he was arrested for an alleged sexual assault. He's from Peoria, Illinois, and Allen is basically accused of having forced his way into a woman's car, forcing her to perform a sex act on him. And all these years later, he went down a path that ended up putting him in prison, even though he never stood criminal trial or was convicted or sentenced for that crime. And he's still in prison today.
Max, how did you first hear about Terry's story?
So Allen's story came to me through some reading on the type of law that is detaining him. It's called a civil commitment. And Allen's case actually went to the Supreme Court in the 1980s. And so his case has been sort of referenced as case law throughout various papers and legal writings. And so as I was doing some background reading on his story, there was a recent paper out of Northwestern University looking at this type of detainment. And the author of that paper mentions Terry Allen's name in her article. And there's just a small aside about how Allen was never actually criminally adjudicated for this crime, but is still in prison today. So upon reading that, I went to the Illinois Department of Corrections internet database. You can look at all the profiles of inmates there. And lo and behold, Terry Allen is still there, and his profile still shows no conviction for this alleged crime.
Sophie Allen is one of hundreds of people across the country who are incarcerated for a crime of which they were not actually convicted. And they're there because of a law that here in Illinois, at least, is called the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. What's the idea behind that law, Sophie?
So the basic idea is to get people who prosecutors and judges think are sexually dangerous off the streets and into a treatment program so that they don't commit a sex crime in the future. But that's a forward-looking law. It's looking towards the future. And the question is what's happening in Illinois and around the country treatment or is it punishment? And in Illinois, all the people who are being held because of this act are held in prisons. And their daily life there is really similar to that of general population inmates.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, distinct from the Department of Human Services, which runs mental health hospitals for people who have been found insane, although we don't use that term legally. But Max, how many people in Illinois, you said you were looking at the Department of Corrections records, how many people in Illinois are currently incarcerated under the SDP or Sexually Dangerous Persons Law?
It's currently 171. That number has fluctuated between, you know, about that and a little bit higher than that over the past few years. And interestingly enough, the restrictions around how this law is used have become greater over the years. It's in theory should have become more difficult for prosecutors to detain people in this way. However, the population has never been higher than it is right now. If you look back a few decades, the population of people detained under the law was much lower.
So Max, ostensibly this is not about punishment. Again, ostensibly, but what is supposed to happen to sexually dangerous persons while they are in custody?
So the idea, the way it's written in Illinois law and sort of the intention of the state as it's written is that we want to take someone who we believe is at risk to hurt more people in the future, and we want to put them into a treatment program that focuses on talk therapy and sort of a therapeutic focused approach to dealing with what the state says is criminal behavior. How can we get these people who are in our treatment program to sort of understand why they're here and improve their behavior, and how can we measure that? And so in theory, people enter the program, which happens to be in a prison. They go through this treatment, and ultimately the state, you know, wants people to get out, it would seem, based on the way the law is written. But there aren't really many of the types of measurements implemented that you would expect for a program like this. There's no real there aren't check boxes that the state looks at to determine when someone is ready to be released. So even though in theory someone should be getting treatment and be released, you would think maybe in a reasonable amount of time, you get cases like Terry Allen where someone's been there for going on four decades.
Sophie, if we can think back to 1982 when Terry Allen was arrested, how much did he understand about what would happen to him?
So Terry Allen says he had no idea what was going to happen to him under the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. He said initially he thought that the Sexually Dangerous Persons Act might be sort of like a get-out-of-jail-free card, that it could mean a lesser sentence, and he thought that he would be held at a hospital, not at a prison.
Is that pretty common, do we know, of people who are held under these sorts of laws?
Well, like Max said earlier, the law is pretty unusual. There are 171 people held in Illinois under this law. We did find a bunch of other states like Illinois where this law is used in different ways. In the states where they use it in the most similar way, that's Massachusetts, North Dakota, and the federal system, there are about 300 individuals held under laws like the SDP Act. And so that's a pretty small population. So I think it's fair to say that unless you knew about it already or were being represented by an attorney who was familiar with the law, there's a pretty good chance it could be confusing or misinterpreted.
And I just want to put a pin in that, Sophie. So Illinois is something of an outlier here when you look at all 50 states that have Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, there are three states, Illinois, Massachusetts, and North Dakota, who do it in the same way that Illinois does, or a very similar way. And they also, there's an SVP Act that's very similar on the federal level as well.
Okay. So Terry Allen has no sentence. He has no release date. Max, you spoke with him about this, and let's listen to what he had to say.
An SDP is told, you go down there, if you recover, we'll let you go. You've had people here in group years and years and years and years and years, and they're still here, and they can't get out. I don't know how you explain that. The law says the briefest time possible, 30 or 40 years. I'm sorry, but it's not a brief time. There's nothing brief about it.
Do you know people that have died here?
Yeah, a lot of them.
People that were told, if you go to group, if you go through the program, you'll get better and you'll get out, but then they don't.
That's true. That's the exact truth of it. I'm over there in healthcare, the healthcare unit, because I broke my hip. And we've had, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 SDPs die at healthcare since I've been over there. 5 of them.
Again, that's Terry Allen speaking with Max Green, who's with us now from WBEZ. Max, when you spoke with Allen, what was his mood like?
It's hard to say. I mean, he is very interested, obviously, in being let go at this point. At points in our interview, he was more worked up about his situation than others. He also is, it seems like he's gotten over the years sort of more of an understanding about why he may have been locked up to begin with, but it is a very, in general, hopeless sort of mood, an impression that I got from him. Again, this is someone who was arrested at 23 and is 60 years old today.
Yeah, and we heard in the clip there that he had broken his hip. I guess is what you sent him to the infirmary.
Yeah, a couple of years ago he had taken a fall, and is when I interviewed him, he was in a wheelchair, and so he's been dealing with that injury, and I think mentioned to me he needs some follow-up surgeries relating to that.
All right, so Sophie McKibben, is part of this episode of the Frontline Dispatch podcast, we also hear from an advocate for victims of sexual assault. What was her perspective on this?
Yeah, we talked to Sarah Layden. She works at a nonprofit called Resilience, and she shared with us that in general, sex crimes are underreported and underprosecuted. So laws like the SDP Act are necessary to help the state make sure that people who are unsafe are not able to continue to harm others. However, she did say that the SDP Act might not be a perfect solution, and she thought that it was important that SDPs receive adequate treatment while in prison.
So Max, there's a former prosecutor in Sangamon County, which is where Springfield is located, who was actually one of the big drivers when it came to the use of this law. Her name is Cheryl Essenberg, and she even wrote a manual called Prosecutor's Guide to the Illinois Sexually Dangerous Persons Act. You spoke to her. I wanted to play a clip of something she said to you.
I think the law has to be used carefully. But if there's a legal way that I can prevent a person who's, in my mind, pretty clearly going to commit that next offense, if I can intervene before he commits that next offense with a high degree of certainty, then I'm going to do that.
So, Max, when you spoke with former prosecutor Cheryl Essenberg, what did you learn from her?
So Essenberg, you know, she laid out for me that in her history working in the state's attorney's office there in Sangamon, she would see cases often enough that she started to use this law that to her really made it seem like this law was reasonable and needed to be on the books. Cases where you would see someone who had all the characteristics of a high risk repeat offender. Maybe they ended up in court a couple of times. Maybe there were a series of allegations made against a given person, and for whatever reason, a traditional type of criminal prosecution might not be feasible. There might not be the kind of evidence that a prosecutor would think that they would need, or the ability to evaluate that evidence in a courtroom. Maybe there's someone who doesn't want to testify against the person. And so she, as a prosecutor, sort of had this perspective that I have enough, I've seen enough to know that this guy is likely that he may do something else to hurt someone else. And this law, I think Essenberg views it as a tool that prosecutors have to sort of intervene in those moments when they really do think that someone is high risk to hurt more people. So as controversial as it might seem, I think that there's a very pragmatic element of how prosecutors in the state use this. And I think that that speaks to part of why Essenberg did so much work to try to let other prosecutors know that this law is even out there. Again, this is on the books. It originated in the 1930s. So it's not a very widely known thing.
Yeah. So, well, Max, let's take a step back here. And I mean, this is it's an old law. There have been thoughts about changing it over the years. One person you spoke with is Mark Heyerman. He's a law professor at the University of Chicago, and he is among the people who thinks the law needs to change. Here's what he said to you.
If this is a civil commitment, why are they in a facility operated by the Department of Corrections? What sense does it make to have the Department of Corrections do this? Why aren't they in the custody of the Department of Human Services that runs our 7 state psychiatric hospitals? And I think it's partly because we want to say to these people, look, you did a bad thing and you're being punished.
So, Max, that's Mark Heyerman's view. What is the history of Illinois? Has Illinois ever, you know, lawmakers ever thought of changing this law?
Well, the law has been amended a couple of times over the years. You know, it did originate in the 1930s, but the burden of proof necessary to use the law has changed. A couple other aspects of it have changed. Heyerman actually led, he was the executive director of a governor's appointed commission in the late 80s that was tasked with looking at and evaluating criminal and mental health laws in the state. And that was, you know, over 30 years ago at this point. That group, that commission, actually looked at this law specifically and made a recommendation to state legislators that it be repealed. They basically made the case that, look, this law is well-intentioned, but the science and the sort of understanding of criminal behavior that we had when it was written has evolved, has changed. And we, as a group of, you know, legislators, experts, mental health people, clinicians, believe that it's really not necessary, that there are other ways to handle these kinds of cases that are perhaps better suited to the cases, more fair. But that recommendation wound up not going anywhere. So that is, I think, the most recent sort of recommendation to the legislature that I could find that something be evaluated, be reevaluated, be changed about this. To our understanding, nothing has actually happened.
Yeah, I, as somebody who covers the legislature, you do not see a lot of legislation that would sort of ease restrictions or ease the situation for people who have been accused of sex crimes ever really moving through.
And that's a point. Oh, I'm sorry. That is a point that Heyerman made to me, that it is not something that voters and constituents necessarily want to see their elected officials doing, going to bat to potentially ease laws that that are allegedly keeping people who are dangerous off the streets.
So, Sophie, we're almost out of time, but what sort of response have you gotten to this podcast episode?
We've gotten a lot of great and interesting response, some really interesting discussion on Facebook and on Twitter about what you do in these types of situations and what our legal system, you know, in this country, how it works and how it should work. So there have been a lot of interesting discussions happening.
And Max, one last question before we go. What is next for Terry Allen?
So Terry Allen actually did get approved for a what's called a conditional release a couple of years ago. The issue that he's having now is that he has to register as a sex offender, even without a conviction for the sex crime on his record. Which, of course, means that he has to meet sort of this this long list of rules that the state has about where he can live. And Allen has had a really hard time with that. He's technically allowed to leave the prison, but he has to find somewhere to go first. And just to illustrate how difficult that can be, I actually got a call from the prison this week. They were asking me if I knew of an address that Allen could go, somewhere that he could live outside of the prison. They didn't realize I was the reporter who'd come there, but they did tell me that I'm only one of only 2 or 3 names on his list of contacts after decades behind bars. So I think that just goes to show how difficult it can be for someone in his position to find somewhere to go.
Yeah. All right. Well, that is WBEZ reporter Max Green speaking to us from Chicago. We also spoke with Frontline producer Sophie McKibben from Boston. We'll tweet out a link to the podcast at 21st Show. Sophie, Max, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. As we've talked about quite a bit here on the show, and as you might know from your own life, student debt can create more than just a financial burden. It can hurt your chances of getting a job. It slows down your retirement savings. It can even stall marriage plans, according to some studies. And a survey shows that young people with student debt are finding that to be a huge obstacle when it comes to buying a home. That's according to Country Financial, which is based in Bloomington. Dennis Rodkin from Crane's Chicago Business recently wrote about this, and he joins us from Chicago. Natalia Abrams is also with us. She's the executive director of StudentDebtCrisis.org, which is based in Los Angeles. Both of you, welcome back.
Hi, how are you?
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for being here. And I also want to welcome Vic Gandhi, who Dennis featured in his Crane's article. He's 29, lives in Chicago, and knows about this student debt issue firsthand when it comes to trying to buy a home. Vic, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, thanks for having me.
So, Vic, I gather you and your wife have been interested in buying a home. When did you first learn that student debt would be an obstacle to that?
So we've been looking realistically for the past maybe 8 months or so, and I think as we started thinking about, you know, down payment and how much we wanted to have versus how much we wanted to spend, the idea of how much we're paying monthly for both of our student loans kind of hit us in terms of how that money could be going towards our mortgage or down payment.
Did it surprise you?
A little bit. I think, you know, when early on, when you're kind of out of grad school and you're working, those things don't really add up as much because you're not thinking about how much it actually takes. But I think, you know, as you get older and as you have to start thinking about, putting that money down, you also start thinking about areas that you could save potentially. So, yeah, a little bit of a surprise.
So, Dennis, you spoke to other millennials for your reporting. You also heard from quite a few on social media. Was Vic's story common or uncommon?
Pretty common. I mean, I think, if you're not affected by student debt, you're unlikely to respond. But the thing that was interesting is I was just writing this short article based on a survey from Country Financial, which said that two-thirds of college-educated millennial-aged renters in Illinois say that student loan debt is the primary factor keeping them out of the housing market. Short article, I said on Twitter, hey, if you're one of these people, college-educated millennial renter, I'd like to talk to you. And my Twitter inbox was full. I must have, in an hour, heard from 25 people saying, yeah, I'd like to talk. And I had to say, oh, thank you to a bunch of them. And the things that people were saying were, I mean, they were all the same. They were, I had no idea these debts would weigh me down so much. Yeah, I've put it off for 2, 3, 5 years. Oh, we have to give up on the idea of buying in general. It was pretty surprising.
And Natalia, when we talk about people living with student debt on a larger scale, beyond just as it relates to housing, can you remind us exactly how big a problem that is?
Yes, Brian, it's a huge problem. So we have 45 million student loan borrowers that hold $1.5 trillion, that's trillion with a T, of overall student loan debt. In your state, in Illinois, you have almost 2 million borrowers that owe about $56 billion. So that's a lot, you know, just for the state of Illinois. And, you know, from our research, we've read that Illinois borrowers spend about 40% of their income on student debt. So it's no surprise that there's not money left over to purchase a home.
Yeah, and just looking at some of the numbers across the country, 46% of millennials said saving for a down payment is the key barrier to buying a house. I imagine Natalia is not surprised that Dennis's Twitter inbox filled up. Dennis, what are we seeing here in Illinois?
Well, of course, I cover primarily Chicago, and one of the reasons I was surprised that so many people would be saying it in Chicago is that while Chicago is expensive relative to the rest of the state, it's inexpensive relative to other major cities in America. So if the number was for Illinois, but I would assume that the great majority of those of people who are priced out of a new home by student debt are in and around the city of Chicago. And yeah, and we see it. I mean, a couple of years ago, there was a real estate forecaster who said that in Chicago and other major cities, millennials were the key to reviving the housing market. I guess it's now 3 years later. Millennials have been pretty slow to buy. They're buying, but they have not taken as many homes off the market in the Chicago area as was forecast a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I mean, you really don't hear Chicago talked about in the same way you do San Francisco or New York City, but maybe there's something lurking that we're not aware of, Dennis, or that we are now, I guess.
Well, yeah, I think so. Yeah, and again, there would be a shock if you were moving from somewhere else in Illinois to Chicago. Chicago is so different as a housing market from the rest of the state. But if you look at other major cities, homes are relatively inexpensive. What I don't know is I don't know enough about salaries to know if that same millennial is making proportionally more in San Francisco, Dallas, Portland, the places that are so expensive. But yeah, we hear the complaints here in Chicago quite a bit.
Natalia, your organization advocates for state and federal policies that would lessen the effect of student debt. We're talking here about student debt as an obstacle to owning a house. So when a relatively young person like Vic is, let's say, hypothetically turned down for a loan because of his student debt, what are some ways that might affect him or her in ways that we might not be thinking about?
So, you know, one of, I think, the sadder things that is going on is that there are federal repayment plans that can be very helpful if you're struggling to make your monthly loan payments. We've advocated for them, but these plans are not perfect. And so, unfortunately, these plans can hurt you when you're looking to purchase a home, especially if you're at something like a $0 payment. They won't look at it as you're freeing up income to pay your mortgage. They look at it more that of your overall number, which is very large nowadays for student loan borrowers. It's an average of $35,000. So right away, it's not looked at as good debt anymore. That's, I think, where a lot of people are surprised. When I was going to college, I was told student loan debt was good debt to have. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily looked at in the same way at all. It's negatively looked at. They look at these big numbers. And so these federal repayment plans, you know, they should be speaking more with mortgage lenders to let people know that a lot of borrowers are going into them to free up money for mortgage. However, they're then being disproportionately impacted or negatively impacted because these programs can often make them look bad, like they're struggling borrowers. So that's one of the things borrowers need to look out for. You know, I would say if you're looking to buy a home, the name of the game with your student loan is to pay it off as quickly as possible. But I know that's so much easier said than done because so many people's student loan payment, you know, we did our own survey of 7,000 borrowers, and one-third of our borrowers said that their student loan payments was more than their mortgage or their rent, and half can't purchase a home out of our survey that we did last year.
Hmm.
So this is, you know, it's not surprising the response you were seeing on social media. We hear that time and time again. Remember, there's 45 million people out there that are all facing a very similar struggle.
All right, Vic, I want to bring you back into the conversation. So we just heard about, you know, the idea of good debt. You work in the healthcare industry. You and your wife have, what, 3 degrees between you? Is that valuable for you professionally?
I think so. I think, you know, the route I took to, you know, go to undergrad and then get my master's in healthcare administration did set me up for, you know, the position I am in and the position that I will be in for, you know, whatever jobs I do apply for moving forward in my field. I think, you know, the minimum people have is a master's degree. And then if you don't have that, then you're kind of at a ceiling where you need to go back to school or go part time. So I definitely find it valuable. For my master's degree, same with my wife. She is in MP school currently, and she's kind of hit her ceiling being just an RN. So, you know, the financial payout that she'll get in return for going to school and probably accumulating another $30,000-$40,000 in student loans, I think both from a financial perspective and then also from just a career perspective will pay off.
Vic, I wonder, has this experience of trying to buy a house at all changed the way you think about your degrees and what they're worth?
I do. I think about it a lot, you know, just in terms of what I'm actually took away from what I did in school versus what I do now. I don't think, you know, going to a four-year school at Loyola, a private school, was probably the best option. I think most of the stuff that I do now is just kind of learning on the job. And, you know, I think the master's was appropriate at the time. But, you know, I feel like a lot of people take the route just to get the degrees, whereas, you know, a lot of times, unfortunately, you can just learn what you need to do on the job. And, hopefully maybe in the future there could be a way where you can cut out the actual formal schooling and kind of get a role without going through all that hassle and student loans.
Dennis, I want to turn back to the sort of macroeconomic perspective here. What does this trend of difficulty of young people being able to buy homes, what does this mean for the real estate market?
Well, one of the things it means is that if the person who's one step up on the housing chain from the millennial can't sell, then that person can't move up. And, you know, it has a rollover effect. We have a problem with decreasing demand in Illinois and in the Chicago area. As I think you know, Illinois has been losing population year after year for the past 3 years in a row. Chicago area is losing population. The only state that touches the Great Lakes that is losing population is Illinois. And so the decline in the decline in demand from millennials adds to the decline in demand that is helping to make Chicago the slowest rising real estate market among big cities in America.
Natalia,
so it has a big rollover, or it contributes to the rollover effect. There are many other factors, but the loss of millennial demand is certainly a considerable one.
And it's something that you feel reverberating up the housing market food chain, to mix a few metaphors there. Natalia, when it comes to home ownership, are there any solutions to make it more accessible for people who have a large amount of student debt?
You know, I think what I was referring to a bit earlier, if we could have, first of all, if we could make college debt free and start to wipe out debt, that's an obvious big picture solution. But if we can have more consumer protections for student loans and have a conversation between, you know, Treasury and the Department of Education and lenders out there that, you know, these repayment plans that borrowers are going into can actually free up their monthly income, and they need to be, you know, there's a way to consider this as good debt again, especially if it's managed. We need a re-education, and we've actually worked with the National Housing Resource Center to provide workshops for their counselors, and we've talked with other folks within that market. So there is a desire to change that attitude, but I think we eventually need to look at bigger picture solutions, because it's so insidious and so many people have this debt and are struggling every day that we need a bigger solution for the 45 million.
All right, Vic, last question to you. What's next for you and your wife?
You know, I think realistically we'll probably extend our lease for another 6 to 8 months and then really try to buckle down and save. You know, I think, you know, I've talked to a few loan officers and try to understand what we can qualify for and how much we should put down versus incurring PMI. So, you know, I feel like what we have now would just get us to the point of being able to put a down payment and then not being able to furnish, not being able to travel, not being able to do anything. So we definitely don't want to put ourselves in that position right now. So, yeah, I think we'll just have to tighten up a little bit and save pretty hard over the next 6 to 8 months and hopefully revisit the topic at the end of the year or beginning of next year.
That's Chicago and Vic Gandhi. I also want to thank Natalia Abrams from the studentdebtcrisis.org and Crane's Chicago business reporter Dennis Rodkin. We'll tweet out Dennis's story and link to it from our website, 21stshow.org. All of you, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
If Vic's story sounds familiar to you, or if you have a question that you'd like to share about housing, visit askthe21st.org. Our friends at the Illinois Newsroom have been doing a series of stories about this topic, so reach out and share any questions that you have about buying or renting a home. Again, that's askthe21st.org. Coming up on tomorrow's show, more and more high school students are leaving Illinois for college. The latest numbers show that nearly half of public high school grads went to out-of-state institutions. We'll learn more about why this is happening and what should be done about it. That is all the time we have for today. Our website, 21stshow.org, is the place to go. If you're looking for past shows, or if you want to leave us a voicemail or send us an email, we're also now on Spotify, or you can find us on Apple Podcasts, wherever else you get your shows. I'm Brian Mackey, in for Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.